This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Film Movement Plus. And among the many, many independent foreign documentary short feature films that you can currently stream at Film Movement Plus is Reinars Vimba's Mellow Mud, a Latvian export that won the Crystal Bear at the Berlin Film Festival. It is about a teenage girl and her younger brother living with their grandmother in rural Latvia. The old woman suffers a heart attack. The kids try to carry on and run the orchard without telling everybody that their grandmother is gone. And the daughter enters the English language Olympiad in London in the hopes of tracking down her mother, who abandoned the two children years earlier. This is a film that has been called intimate and lyrical, compelling and bittersweet by critics around the world.
I've never seen a film from Latvia.
I don't know that I have either.
And I'm pretty, like, I've listened.
You're a global traveler, cinematically speaking.
Span the globe to bring you the constant variety of cinema.
Thank you, Jim McKay.
And I, as you're reading this copy, I'm like, wait a second. Have I ever seen a Latvian film? I mean, I'm fixing to now because Mellow Mud is...
I bet one has snuck up on us one way or the other.
I'm going to watch it. When was that?
I don't know.
Would be, look, there's a historical record now.
Well, yes.
We've been doing this podcast for 10 years.
Before that, though, you had that whole movies.com period where you were reviewing like every single movie that opened.
That is true.
And so, like, you know, you're one of the eight people in the United States probably that reviewed, you know, A Time for Drunken Horses or whatever. So I bet you some Latvian action got in there somewhere.
Maybe.
Anyway, Film Movement Plus has so much great stuff. They've got the Vietnamese film, The Third Wife.
Which is very good, by the way.
Twin Flower, about emigres from the Ivory Coast trying to make their way in Sardinia.
Which I'm sure is very good. You see what I did there? Like one I know, yes, one I maybe. Listen, it's on Film Movement. It ain't nothing.
Exactly. Philippe Lesage's acclaimed coming-of-age film, Genèse. And that's just a handful of things. And there's more titles being added every week. It's a huge array of stuff.
They don't just toss content at you like Netflix sweeping up a whole package of stuff from, oh, look at this sitcom from wherever, you know. They don't do that.
This is the A-list.
This is curatorial practice, y'all.
Absolutely. So Film Movement Plus.
Don't forget it.
Awesome material there, and a special deal for listeners of Linoleum Knife. You can get a 30-day free trial and 50% off your first three paid months. Use the promo code Knife at checkout, KNIFE at checkout when you go to filmmovementplus.com.
You want to get with some theme music?
Let's.
All right, here we go. Oh, okay, of course.
Oh, naturally. Like
No. It's the CD player's fault, not mine.
Okay, fine.
Not mine.
It's a historic episode. Why wouldn't we screw it up? A podcast of the cinema
for 10 whole years.
You guys,
10 years.
It's been 10 years.
Now we are 10.
10 years.
What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. And you?
Dave White.
And this is our show.
We're film critics.
We are.
One of us is employed, the other is not.
At the moment.
But we're married in the same house, so one of us has money.
There you go. As it such as it is.
And that's good, because after 10 years, that freelance lifestyle getting weirder and weirder.
Absolutely. And this was a thing we created to have a thing that we could create. You know, it is kind of nuts. I've mentioned to people lately, we're hitting our 10th anniversary, and I've heard people say, were you the first podcast?
I'm like, yes, we invented podcasts. Yes. We wrote the very first podcast.
Yeah, exactly. And I wrote the very first song. But what's been exciting to tell people is that we owe it all to our guest this week. Who else would we have on our 10th anniversary podcast if not the mother of the House of Linoleum Knife, Ms. Gray Drake?
Say her name.
Woo. I can't even. It's Oh, Hoomst. Sure. From
whom? Lots of. We sprang fully formed, grown
at
from
the
your
side of her head.
From the skull of you.
You guys, it's such an honor to have that distinction in the Linoleum Knife universe. It's funny because all these years have passed, all these years of me like gazing upon you like your weird skull mother would. Yes. Yeah. And being so proud of what you put out into the world and your creativity that you share and your knowledge and all of this. And I think it is, we are far past the time that you need to be gracious to me. Far past.
Well, but see, in the grand pyramid scheme that all podcasting really is, but we keep that a secret, Gray has been like getting the kickbacks all this time, you know, from having launched us. And then it's upon us to then find new podcasters to be below us. And so the whole process keeps going.
Paid in chocolate chip muffins and pancakes and donuts.
Bacon, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we're more than square. I love you guys so much. It truly is an honor to be here. When you asked me to join you today, I literally went squee.
So let's tell the origin story because that's.
Hang on, before we do that, let's tell the listeners. Mm-hmm. There will be reviews today.
Oh yes, we're getting there.
We have three films to talk about.
They're in the title of this episode and everything.
However. Sit back because it's going to be a minute before we get to that. If you just come for reviews and you don't want all the chit chat and the lollygagging and the falderol, you can just bump it forward to like 20 minutes from now.
Yeah, at least
because
we have a yarn to spin.
We've got some talking to Gray Drake to do.
That's right.
All right, now we go.
Okay. Right. And obviously for our long-term listeners, they know this story very well, but now, you know, we new folks are coming along all the time and attention must be paid. So before this show started, so like I would say circa 2008, 2009,
something,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dave and I had no idea what a podcast was.
No, we did because we watched The L Word and Alice.
Oh, that's true, yes.
Alice on The L Word had a podcast and everyone made fun of her for having a podcast.
Right.
They'd be like, oh, your little podcast.
Exactly.
And that was part of the cultural conversation about podcasts.
They were like, kind of a joke.
They were a thing that were sort of like no traction.
It was like vlogging.
Yeah. You were doing literally nothing if you had a podcast. This is not far from the truth. However, they made it seem extra nothing on The L Word. And when you then came to me, well, no, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yes.
Continue.
So one night I was at the silent movie theater and the projectionist comes running down from the booth. And I would learn that this woman's name was Gariana. And I'd never met her before, but she knew who I was. And she wanted to know if I would come on her podcast called Popcorn Mafia.
Yes.
My next question, of course, is what's a podcast again? How does that work? Who?
And what? You were like, what is a popcorn mafia?
Also that. Yes. All new to me. And so I then found myself in... you know, it was called the Treehouse, and that wasn't entirely hyperbole.
Right.
It was this funky little guest house in the valley.
In the hills.
Well, yep. In the hills of the valley.
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're both right.
Okay.
And who should be there but Ms. Gray Drake, whose house it was. And we spent the next hour talking about movies into a microphone. And I was like, I don't know where this is going. I don't know how any of this works, but I'm having a good time and this is fun.
There was a website. It said popcornmafia.whatever.
Yeah.
And you would go there and listen to it. It was a podcast.
I didn't have a smartphone yet. You sat at your computer and you put your headphones in and you listened to a show.
That's right. How long did you do Popcorn Mafia?
Two Ladies Talking Movies. Back in, so we did the podcast, gosh, it ran from 2008 until 2012.
Wow.
In a couple different iterations. And it started because Gary Ann and I worked at a movie theater together. Mm. And all we did back then with the zero money that we had and the perhaps negative bank balances that we had, we would steal the popcorn at the end of the day from the theater. We would take it in gigantic garbage bags and we would go back to somebody's place and we would drink this really cheap beer that had a turtle on it. And it was, I think it's like Kaguama. But we just called it turtle beer because most of us were white. And so we would eat popcorn, drink turtle beer, talk about movies, have the time of our lives. And we wanted to recreate that. And we're having a little bit of trouble pitching a television show at the time. Although I did send our pitch reel directly to Mark Cuban, who shockingly never responded.
Well, how dare he?
I know. He's sorry now.
Could have been on the ground floor of all this.
And Gary Ann had heard of podcasting because a very popular comedian, Jimmy Pardo, had a very successful show. And he actually was one of the first podcasters to get people to pay for the show. He's well known in the comedy community. I think that he like did a stint as an announcer on a late night show at some point. And we decided to dip our toe in, and we realized that pretty soon the format that worked was we talk about a couple movies and a couple trailers, and we would bring in luminaries from the film world that we love to talk to. So that's why Gary Ann got so excited when she realized that she knew the great Alonzo Duraldi, because she was like, oh my God, we're going to like bring these people in, and they're like legit. It's going to be so fun. And so I was just like, this sounds fantastic. I'm sure I'm in way over my head. But the minute that you entered the treehouse, which was my, like you said, guest house with studio apartment, and like, I just had strangers like 2 feet away from my bed, and we just pretended that it wasn't happening.
We've all been there.
Right? And I think it added like a real air of magic and wonder to the show. But you came in with treats. And I it was love at first sight. I was like, everything about this man, like if he opens his mouth and even says something dumb, you know, like maybe even if he starts talking about like cinema verite or something, like on a show when we're discussing Transformers, I'm still going to love him.
The power of snacks, never underestimate.
You introduced me to the friggin' sand. What is that? The
limonada.
Limonada?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been fancy ever since.
I come correct. So I did the show. Dave did the show.
Yeah. I remember nothing except that it was a few months later, I think. And then one of y'all, it was either you or Gariana, contacted Alonzo, maybe, I think. And somehow it got to me. And I remember thinking, what am I supposed to say when I go? Like, I don't know how to, I don't want to be out in the world. Like, and so.
This is a recurring theme.
I thought, all right, well, I don't remember what Alonzo brought as treats. But I knew that as a person who was invited somewhere by complete strangers, that I had to bring treats myself. So I baked chocolate chip cookies and brought them with me.
Always a one-upper.
And well, you know, I'm a bacon man.
You are a bacon man.
So not a B-A-C-O-N
well,
man.
Well, that too, but you're also a B-A-K-I-N-G.
Yeah, bacon apostrophe. Yeah. I brought chocolate chip cookies. And then I swear the only conversation about this moment that I remember was that you and I, Gray, discussed the differences in quality between the Snuggie and the Slanket and the budget cashmere throw that I had purchased years earlier.
Wow, yes, exactly. Because I honestly, Dave, when just before you said that, I kept wondering why I wanted to talk about Snuggies now. And you just reminded me, it's absolutely what it was. And this, the whole point of the show was to embrace kind of that, like an adjacent to that Seinfeld idea of like talking about nothing. I know that they've said that's not exactly what the pitch was for the show, but it's that was. But I live for that, and I figured that if we had these generous, intelligent, talented people join us on the show, that by God we were going to make it weird, and it was such a special little room of weirdness to me.
Before Popcorn Mafia, I did not know what a Bibs was.
Yep.
you were our introduction to that phenomenon.
That's right. You made us one of the planets orbiting the sun of William Bibbiani.
Yes, you're here. And that's one of the reasons that I can look back on my career so fondly, is because there's just such a for me and in my memory, there's just such a strong community of talent and movie lovers and just kind, wonderful people that I have not been able to get rid of since.
You're stuck with us.
Right.
So then 2010 rolls around, and I am lucky enough to be part of two different TV shows talking about movies. And in a very quick amount of time, both of those TV shows get canceled.
Because of Alonzo.
Yes, I single-handedly torpedoed them.
He sunk them.
By being on them with my giant head. Yeah, the Rotten Tomatoes show on Current, and then this show on IFC that our friend Michael Pressman hosted, or produced rather, called The Grid. Actually, no, Jesse Thorne later hosted that show. Now that I think about it, I knew there was some connection there. But anyway, both those shows, dead. And so I came home one day to Dave White and I said, I want a thing that nobody can cancel but us. And I want to do a thing that we own, that we control, that can't just be snatched away. I said, I think it's time for us to do a podcast. And Dave's immediate response was,
no.
You didn't want to do it. You didn't want to be out in the world. And the initial pitch was like, well, it's not going to be on video. We're not going to do a YouTube show. It's just going to be audio. It's not going to be, you know, that you don't have that pressure of having to perform for the camera. It's just going to be us talking.
Yeah.
So I eventually talk him into doing it. And then thankfully.
Well, he was like, would you do this for love? And I said, because of love, fine.
Look,
that's how he gets you every time.
Yeah, look, you use the whatever in your, you know, your quiver.
Yeah.
So then, thankfully, Gray came through with a rig that pieces of which we are still using.
What pieces of it are we still using?
Well, we have a different soundboard now, but I think some of these mics are probably still the ones that we bought from her, and some of these cables I'm looking at.
Hmm.
So yeah,
that's why we sound like we do.
I knew less than nothing about how to make any of this happen, and she like very patiently sort of like walked me through it, and I got to the point where it was sort of like when I was a projectionist in high school. I didn't know how to like fix the projector if anything went wrong, but I knew exactly how to hook everything up and start it and press the button and make it go. So that's something. And 10 years later, I'm still pretty much there, but you know. So our original podcast rig we bought from Gray Drake.
Well, and we had also learned, oh, please applause. Thank you so much. Yes. That's how we started too. I know just enough about tech and equipment to be dangerous.
Yes.
And I'm good at logically understanding how to connect devices. So I was able to, we had actually purchased when we started a podcasting kit from a movie equipment house in Hollywood. And so it had everything that we needed, but we were short one mic, which for a while we stole from the only horrible man I've ever dated.
then you earned it, really.
Yeah. And eventually he realized that I had it, and after we had broken up he wanted it back, and so I finally asked Gary Ann to give it back to him, because I knew that he wouldn't want to deal with her. and And so they organized a handoff, and my God, I'd give anything to know how that went that day. I mean, but he's still alive as far as I know. So, and so over time we sort of acquired more things from people. And so we had basically a double set, and that's what we ended up giving you guys. And so it was, I was able to transfer like my lack of knowledge to meet with your lack of knowledge, and together we made almost a whole knowledge.
10 years later, we still have almost a whole knowledge.
Exactly.
Well, let me say it differently. Alonzo has almost a whole knowledge. Yeah, I was going to say,
who's this we you're talking about?
If Alonzo were to be hit by the double-decker bus tomorrow, everything would fall to pieces, because I would have A, no podcasting partner, B, no understanding of what to do with any piece of equipment that is on this table right now, including my own laptop.
Yeah, no, listen, honey, that's why you just sit there and look pretty. It's fine.
I am extremely cute.
There you go.
Yeah, we're all
bringing something to the table.
Yeah.
So we launched this thing. We launched this thing the month before I went on a book tour, which was maybe not the greatest idea. Maybe we should have just waited until after, but you know, like many a podcast, we started and then we took a month off, but then we came back, and we've actually been back, you know, pretty regularly ever since. There's very few weeks that we've missed in that time.
Like death in the family kind of situations.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised. Right, and I mean, I'm sorry, what?
Oh no, I was just going to say, you got, it was clear from the beginning that you guys had exactly what it takes to become successful in this little corner of an industry that is entirely self-motivated. You need the skill set, you need the relationships, you need the diligence, consistency, and everyone follows you. And that's why you've continued to be this successful.
Medium success.
Or cult failures is what I like to think of it as. But but no, I mean, luckily it helped that, you know, I think a lot of people tackle these shows that are about topics that require a lot of outside research on top of whatever it is they do for a living. And we are doing a show that sort of dovetails with what we were already doing for a living, which is we were already reviewing movies places. So we were already seeing stuff every week and already kind of having to stay plugged into new releases. So to then just sit down and have a talk about it for originally 20 minutes per episode, which Dave thought was where we needed to be.
I had a vision.
It wasn't like, you know, yes, I spend all day working at, oh, say, Four Seasons Landscaping, and then I have to come home and, like, you know, brush up on the Peloponnesian Wars to talk about it for the podcast.
Right. Yeah, we bring all of our scholarship with us everywhere we go.
You know, it's why, like, our Patreon extra episodes are about things like television and food. It's like, well, again, we're just doing this anyway. We might as well have a conversation about it.
Precisely.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
So,
and I was you know, doing this podcast, and when a spot opened up at movies.com for a critic to, like, a yin to Dave White's yang.
Yes.
Shall we say?
They wanted a he said, she said.
That's why they movies.com called me, and they said, can you write? And I said, well, if you're asking if I'm literate, I guess.
Let's say yes.
The great thing about that moment at movies.com with you and me is that neither of us were forced to be real critics in that moment. Like, I was hired at movies.com to do one very specific thing, and that was write tiny little bullet point nugget sized, breezy, fun,
blurby,
chatty things about movies, not to be a film critic, not to write a real formal, you know, thoughtful review. It was how many years was I there before they told me? I did it for 6 years before they said, you know what? We want you to go to a regular format now instead of just these little ha-ha bullet points.
When to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. And I said, thank you for letting me graduate. Because those first 10 years of working as a film critic, I never would call myself a film critic. I would say, I'm a writer. Because I knew film critics. I lived with one. I was around them all the time. I mean, like, you don't like hang with Manola Dargis while she's writing real reviews and you're writing, you know, hey, here's the time when you can get up and go pee, you know, like you, that's, she's a film critic. You're a guy who got hired to write funny stuff about movies.
But you were sneaking things into this.
I was talking about films that were important films,
yes,
in the goofiest way imaginable.
Also true.
And so when people would say to me, oh, you're a film critic, I would say, well-ish. And so when you came along to movies.com, I thought, good. Now it feels like there's a reason for me to be doing this nonsense. Like, we can both do nonsense together. And part of the pleasure of working with you at movies.com was, obviously, all the times the movies didn't screen for press and we could meet at the Grove for donuts and go see the movie together and hang out and make each other laugh.
Oh, just the best of times. Like, I think I bring that story up only to reiterate that for everything that you guys credit me for, I feel that you have given me so much more and have genuinely shaped the course of my life, truly. There's no question about it. Because that was when my life completely changed. And being a part of this community and getting to, who's getting misty?
This is all too much pressure for me.
You guys are the best.
you were a star waiting to be discovered, Gray Drake. So, you know. Any like uncovering of the bushel we did, you know, that's that was the tiniest amount that somebody else would have done or you would have done yourself. But thank you for that.
You had already been on camera.
Now that I made it weird.
Well, for a second there, it looked like, I think movies.com became the feeder for Rotten Tomatoes, because before you were at movies.com, Jen Yamato was.
Right.
And then she left to go to RT. And then you came in. And then you left to go to RT.
Right. That's the thing. I was taking. Yes.
Oh, sorry. And then Rotten Tomatoes didn't want me at all. And movies.com asked me if I would take a pay cut. But go on, darling.
I was for quite some time, was gladly taking all of Jen Yamato's sloppy seconds, like 100%. So honored. What an intelligent, wonderful woman she is. It's wild that you guys have been doing this for this long, because those things are as vivid to me as they would be if they happened like a year ago. You know, it's the way that you guys have rolled with the punches and had learned far more actually than I know now. The student has truly become the teacher. Way to go.
It is that thing of like, you know, Dave and I are both past the age of 50. And so this is the thing that happens, but it's sort of like 10 years, really? Because it simultaneously feels like we just started this thing and we've been doing this thing forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, what is time, right? The question that I ask myself almost every day now.
Yeah, so I say, especially in 2020, it's all gone out the window in terms of perspective, or, you know, get a sense of how long anything lasts or how long we've been inside this apartment, you know.
What a year to love your television. You know what I mean? Like, it's really... It's really helped me a lot. It's very interesting, and I feel like my watching of things has changed greatly this year. And it makes me appreciate. I think before I had like a certain disdain for the subjective quality of criticism, how much it changes within me from time to time. Mm-hmm. And it made me very reluctant to put things in writing because I felt like it was almost unkind in a way. Yeah, like it was, because I mean, it's like, just ask me tomorrow and I could really feel differently about it. And this year definitely is a landmark for me, I think, in changing the way that I see things. So, I mean, in a way, I'm grateful for it. And I think it's made me feel less disdain. Like now I appreciate the subjective quality of what we do and that it is sort of a living, breathing thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the movies don't change, but the way we look at them changes and the world changes and, you know, our perspectives become different. I was just thinking when you were talking about, you know, appreciating our television, like that's how we're seeing everything now. Like, you know, if you're a critic, that's pretty much, unless you are schlepping out to a drive-in for some event, like you're watching everything on a screen or on your laptop or on your home set. And you know, the first time that I have to go review, that I feel that I can review a movie on the big screen again.
Vaccine.
Exactly. Like after, like we always say, you know, tracking treatment and
vaccine.
Yes. you know, I don't know that I can even trust what my own opinion is going to be just from the idea of seeing a movie again on the big screen. It's going to be like walking out of Plato's cave or whatever. Like, whoa, I forgot how overwhelming this is, you know.
You're gonna be like people who saw the train coming toward them.
Exactly.
And ran to get out of the way.
Right.
Well, and also I feel like when I'm currently doing reviews, the dark part that I have operating in my brain I can never say on a 2-minute radio hit is the fact that when I do radio in certain areas where theaters are open and some movies are only available in theaters, right, when they're first released, part of my qualification is this movie good enough to get sick over?
Exactly.
And I always, I mean, obviously the answer is always no, but I think back to like, so Christy Lemire and I one time were at a press screening, I think of 1,000 Words, the Eddie Murphy movie.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, what if that was the last movie I saw and it killed me?
Yeah, right. It's like no movie is worth getting sick over, but especially not, you know, Come Play or something.
Right. Right. I mean, and so it's not ever something that I say, like I said, in like a really quick, snappy radio review, but I'll say folks, it to you guys because I know you get it.
Yes.
I saw The Hottie and the Naughty and I got COVID-19.
It's just brutal to think about. It's like, I can't. Yeah. I'm like, guys, it's really, this performance is not worth it. No. Like,
brave the pandemic for Food Fight, everybody.
Oh, God. I can't ever recommend it with a full heart.
So what's your story these days? Who's signing the paychecks? Who are you working for? What are you doing?
Oh, she's had to pivot, boys. I spent so much time in podcasting back in the day that I am only just now starting my own YouTube channel.
Sweet.
Yeah. So contractually, I was never able to have my own YouTube channel. And so for ages and ages, I just never had one. And all of my work can be found on the Rotten Tomatoes archive and Movie Phone archive. Mm. And so now what I'm doing is I'm taking the Linoleum Knife route and I'm living for me. And it's something that can never be canceled by anybody but me. And I feel powerful. And also nobody approves me to do anything. which isn't true. Actually, I found it to be, it's giving me a new enthusiasm for what I've found to be my favorite part of this, which is sitting down and doing interviews, because I am nosy and because I love to connect with these people whose art has influenced me and will influence other people. And so I get to actually talk, I get to pick and choose the stuff that I want to do. And I'm seeing a lot of things that before I probably wouldn't have had time to cover. And I think the content is, it's, I just am proud of it. I did it, like I did an interview for a documentary on Netflix called Dick Johnson is Dead.
Oh, great movie.
Great movie. It's coming to me at a very, it's not only during this year, but also in a, like, it's just like a very raw time for me. Right. In this documentary, in case anybody out there hasn't seen it, Kirsten Johnson has a father whose name is Dick, and his, so he had a mental health practice and was slowly showing signs of dementia. And her goal in making a documentary about him was, as she says, to literally cheat death. And in the documentary, she kills him over and over in all these really like crazy ways. And it's actually her dad in the documentary. And I can't believe that he agreed to this, especially.
He's a psychiatrist. Starting, he gets it.
Right. But it's like, fun. He was having fun, and it was so weird because like my dad is old and he's like mad at everything. Like, he would never let me do that. And so I was able to get an interview with her, and we sat down for 30 minutes. And so my mom passed away in January. Yes. And she's the first, this is the first member of my close family that's passed. And so it's been grief on top of grief over here. And the documentary was especially meaningful to me, and getting to talk to her and getting to sort through her process while having one of my own was like something that I would never, I don't think, have been able to experience before. And she was so compassionate in this interview, and she was, I just couldn't imagine, like, nuts and bolts, the amount of empathy this woman had to dredge up for everyone interviewing her. I was just like floored by the emotional energy it had to have taken for her to do this, because she was just so connected to me. And also in Zoom, like, that's something that's so hard to do these days. Right. And
she had to hear every interviewer's dead parent story, probably, right?
Correct. And just so compassionate. And I think that her compassion really shows in both the movie and in that interview. And so that's what I've been up to in this world that isn't really looking to hire anybody to do anything.
What is your YouTube channel so everybody can go subscribe?
You can actually just search my name, and it's GRAEDRAKE. And if you remember long vanity URLs, it's Gray Drake Pink Hair Don't Care. So it's like youtube.com/.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
So that, and it's been really fun. It's been fun to do, and it's great. Even though I've been blessed to have a wonderful boss for the majority of years of my career, it's awesome not to have one.
Well, you know, you touch on a thing, and I think one of the things that Dave and I have discovered over the years of getting to do this show is that, you know, Robert Altman used to always talk about how, like, Hollywood makes, you know, hats and I make gloves, you know, and I think that for a lot of freelance positions, you are writing in a certain way, or you are creating sound bites in a certain way, and that's valuable, and there's an audience that wants that. But when you get to be your own boss and do your own show, you get to sort of determine the lay of the land, you know, and so you get to pick who you're going to talk to and for how long and about what. And so, you know, Dave and I have this opportunity to talk about, like, you know, 7-hour Hungarian reissues if we feel like it, in a way that we feel like it in a way that other media outlets are not clamoring for us to do, you know. And I think, you know, I certainly in doing a film and a movie, which has started this year, it's been really great to be able to just have conversations with filmmakers and let them talk about process and stuff, you know. I mean, we got done with Winery KU, who did Rafiki, and talking about that film and this Melanie Laurent film that she was a fan of. And at the end of it, she was like, thank you for just letting me talk about filmmaking, because everybody just wants to talk about the controversy behind Rafiki and it getting banned in Kenya. And it was so nice to just talk about that. And so I think not having a literal boss, but also not an employer that has certain things that they want and don't want, it can be super liberating. Of course, there's no money in it. That's the flip side.
You'd be scrappy.
But boy, it lets me cry on a Zoom with strangers.
Right. Well, all right then. You can't put a price on that.
Shall we discuss the current cinema?
In a moment, after we hear from the other sponsor this week.
That's right. Linoleum Knife is also sponsored by Ovid.tv. Guess what about Ovid?
What?
I wish I knew, because now I'm finding the email. Hey, you guys, Ovid is a streaming platform.
It is.
And here's what they're telling us. If you're like us, you're trying to make some sense of what's happening. We hope this week's films will help. Starting off with the big picture, we are thrilled to present the restored version of legendary situationist Guy Debord's cult film, The Society of the Spectacle. This theoretical post-Marxist film offers extended blocks of text to be read or heard about media and spectacle, along with clips of movies ranging from silent Russian classics to softcore porn. It isn't put together to entertain or even to go down easily, but it rarely ceases to be stimulating and remains a priceless document. That is what Jonathan Rosenbaum said about Society of the Spectacle. Do you know what I'm spitting it out here. Do you know what the Society of the Spectacle is?
Tell me.
I will tell you. Guy Debord, he wrote this 1967 work of philosophy and Marxist critical theory, which posited that authentic social life and experiences had been replaced by the representation of those things. Mm-hmm. And that there's been this degradation of life that means, you know, being is replaced by having, and then having is replaced by appearing. And so, if you imagine someone talking about that in 1967 and then fast forwarding it to, oh, say now, you'll understand social media and the situationists who laid the groundwork for punk rock and
the word performative
and Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. So I recommend three things. Subscribe to Ovid and watch this movie.
Yes.
Of course.
Natch.
And also read The Society of the Spectacle by Guy Debord.
He knows y'all, what's up.
Y'all, yes. That's what, as Ricky would say, that's what's up. the other stuff this week on Ovid is Mr. Fish. Cartooning from the Deep End. It's about a documentary about the cartoonist Mr. Fish and his struggle to stay afloat as cartooning is, you know, increasingly difficult to make money at doing because of newspapers and stuff like that.
They've also got the documentary Feed. Did you ever see that one? I screened it in Dallas once. It's hysterical. It was shot during, I forget which campaign season, but it was basically they had access to the satellite feeds of these interviews as they were happening with different news networks. So it's all the moments before the interview starts where they're like getting comfortable and harumphing and like you see one guy literally put a comb in his mouth and then slick it through his hair. It's like politicians when they don't think they're on camera. I think after this movie, they knew they were on camera all the time.
Did we ever talk about One Bright Shining Moment?
I don't know.
The McGovern documentary from 1972. It's about the 1972 McGovern campaign when he was running against Nixon. This sort of, you know, progressive grassroots, you know, candidacy. Mm-hmm. This great documentary about that situation, not about the situationists. No. That's Guy Debord,
but the situation on Jersey Shore.
That's also in this package that includes Feed mm-hmm. on Ovid is called Democracy and Its Discontents. It's, yes. it's an entire collection.
Umbrella. They've got Chisholm 72 about Shirley yeah. Chisholm's campaign in 72 to be president. Now that we have a black vice president, you know, this is a, something of a fulfillment of that original goal. There's the Eugene V. Debs doc. Mm-hmm. Because
yeah, which socialism. I think we've talked about the Eugene Debs doc so many times.
Well,
every
it's,
time
it's 2020.
Half Dave. The time we talk about Ovid, we're like, and the Eugene Debs documentary. It's like, yeah, we get it, you guys. You're socialists.
Anyway, so much going on at Ovid.tv, and not all political stuff, all kinds of incredible films from around the world. And for listeners of Linoleum Knife, use the code Linoleum, L-I-N-O-L-E-U-M, get 50% off the first 3 months when you check out at Ovid.tv. That's O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David.tv.
I love having sponsors, and I love having sponsors that are things that we actually like.
Yes.
I mean, remember that time
Audible... We're not brought to you by Slankit.
Remember that time Audible gave us a shot?
Yes.
And they were like, you're fine. You're not big enough for us to care about.
You're a blip. Go away.
So goodbye.
But we appreciate them reaching out.
It was nice, I suppose. But, you know, it's like... I'm more into this.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
All right, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I did say the current cinema.
Yes.
But we're going to put that in quotes because Operation Christmas Drop, I think, barely qualifies.
Oh, well, you know, you would say that, Dave White.
Yes, I would. And I am.
This is, I'll tell you, Netflix is not sitting around and waiting for the moss to grow when it comes to Christmas stuff.
They sure aren't.
They are in it to win it.
Yeah.
So this is their big movie that's dropping this week.
Big. It drops.
do we get to talk about this?
Okay, sure.
The movie you haven't seen, by the way?
No, I was sitting right here at the table. I was there.
Cat Graham plays an assistant to a very high-strung senator played by Virginia Madsen, who's running the House Armed Services Committee, sorry, a congressperson, and is looking to close military bases and sets her eyes on one in Guam that has been getting some publicity for running a thing called Operation Christmas Drop. And so Cat Graham's character goes to Guam to check it out. The guy in the base who was showing her around and who is also the spearhead of Operation Christmas Drop is played by Alexander Ludwig, who does not look bad in a military uniform. I'll just say that. Anyway, you know, she finds out that this is a really valuable humanitarian thing where they go and drop supplies to all of the other islands, you know, generators and radio equipment and food and water and books and, you know, all kinds of things like that. But of course, she's getting pressure from Washington. They got to close this thing down. It basically, this is, if you liked the Elephant movie last year with Rob Lowe and Kristen Davis. This is this year's Southern Hemisphere, we don't have to pretend like it's snowing, Netflix movie. It is also it is also a troops movie, which if you watch Hallmark, you know we're going to get a couple of those every year. It is maybe a little more aggressively propagandistic because it is a really telling you about this Operation Christmas Drop thing, which is a real thing. But apparently it's a thing that is so successful that no senator in their right mind would ever try to close it down. So that's a totally add-on story, like we're watching Sully or something.
And additionally, no one within their right mind would criticize it because it is also participants all over the world. So it's like, yes, Japan and Australia also do this.
Right.
And so I love that aspect of it because it really, while, you know, I mean, a little like just a smidgen jingoistic, of course, you know, just by nature. I still thought it was educational. I was like, what a great program. Is this, you know, is it, hey, let me send a tweet about it. I don't know.
No, I mean, it's cool that it exists. It's just funny when they do a movie about it, it has to be a thing now that's being, you know, that's somehow in danger of being stopped. Like, oh yes, let's stop this really popular program that actually does what it's supposed to do, which is, you know, like, make it so that we can have this strategically necessary base in a place in a part of the world that might otherwise not be dying to have us there, you know.
Oh no, the military might need money. Oh no, what if the military doesn't have enough money? to keep doing this thing that has nothing to do with killing people? Will they have to sacrifice killing people in order to keep this program afloat? And will there be romance?
Well, that's the thing. So many of these movies, although I have to say, and we're talking about this on LKTV and elsewhere, the Hallmark movies are getting better written this year to the point where they're going out of the way to call out the old cliches, which I think is funny. Like somebody's like, oh, what if we moved the dance into the barn? And somebody's like, no, that's a fire hazard. Are you kidding? Because there's always a barn, you know. Anyway, a lot of these movies do kind of boil down to who's in it and how are they together. And I have to say, Cat Graham and Alexander Ludwig, they got the chemistry. They are a nice couple. You want to see them get together. They banter well. There's a little bit of like, you know, prickly heat, if you will, between them at first. And then they, you know, it becomes romantic. It's fine.
And I also thought that Cat Graham, like she looked really congressional when she had her hair up, and then she felt, I was glad she went to the islands and just let it flow. And I thought she looked equally convincing in both sides of her personality, because women are complicated, everybody. I'm here to tell you.
She could do the power suit. She could do a sarong. It's all in her spectrum.
I loved the part where they let her put her hair down.
Yeah, I mean, it showed her acting range, Dave. Shut up. I do just right off the bat in this movie. So I'm not nearly the Christmas film aficionado that some people in this podcast are, but I love a good warm fuzzy, and I definitely like when it kind of veers from the normal. And so while I didn't find that this one veered from the normal at all, I did think the warm fuzzy was there in abundance because truly this program gives so many opportunities to people, and they showed that in a such a way that made me feel like Christmas is everywhere. and so I really like that part of it, but I do have to say, like right off the bat, I was like, oh no, Alonzo, this is going to be what we refer to as Gecko Gate. Because about I want to say right in the beginning, so it's like maybe 15 minutes in, when this uptight woman has arrived, and there was a mistake about picking her up from the plane, and she had to go to the beach to see him half naked first and was super annoyed. He takes her to her quarters, which is like a nice hotel room or whatever, and then just right on the wall is this completely ridiculous CG gecko that looks like it was like the movie was released before they finished animating it.
You think he was going to sell you car insurance?
Truly, like, but not car insurance though, like that he was going to offer me like a fifth of gin and then leer at me in the shower. Like this is, it was so glaring. And then he gives like, Alexander Ludwig gives this casual, like before she's even in the room, he's like, if you see a gecko, it's good luck. And I was like, boo.
Yeah, this is like, this is middle echelon at best, but you know, like as these things go, I have and will see much worse.
Yeah. And I get it. You know, it's like they're putting these out on a tight budget, and they really need to like keep it within their means. And so maybe they just went to like, you know, wherever like the Pixar animators all went to school, Caltech or whatever.
Yeah, I think so.
Something like that. But then they like got like the freshmen. You know what I mean? They had them do it that way.
The high school, I was like, oh, God. The summer program.
And let me be perfectly, sorry. I'm talking over you.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to. It's hard when you're not in the room because I can't see your mouth moving, and I don't know, when it's time to jump in or not. So I apologize. Let me be perfectly clear. I have known and do know many people who are a troop. I appreciate the work they do.
Yes.
I appreciate the humanitarian efforts. that are, you know, represented by the Operation Christmas Drop. But geez, these movies.
Well, this one specifically, it made me think about Their Finest in terms of like, oh, this is what a propaganda movie looks like. Mm-hmm. Like it is, there is such an intentional goal of like selling you on this government program and like dramatizing it in a way. And oh no, the wind, there's a tornado coming. What if they don't get to do the Christmas drop? And it's like, I think if they did it on the 27th, it would not be the end of the world. I think the Islanders would like hold out and be fine, but they turn it into this whole contrived drama. Like, well, the planes get to go and, you know.
Sell people on the Green New Deal. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Like, more propaganda in that direction, please. But I did like Virginia Madsen's like complete willingness to cancel Christmas.
She was so grinchy in this movie that I swear to God, by the end of it, I did see her heart grow three sizes.
Pretty much, yeah. You do get that moment where she's like, well, okay.
And she was literally green.
Yeah, and it was, I think that was actually just a color timing issue over at Netflix, but it's fine. It's fine.
They proposed the gecko. It didn't work out.
I'm all for like thinly veiled propaganda when it has to do with singing popular Christmas carols but inserting like beach terms.
Oh yeah, that was
I love that scene. And she's first meeting the Islanders and Dave, don't you dare argue with me, you're wrong. And she said something about she's supposed to add like a line to the whatever song he's playing on the ukulele. And she says something like, she panics and says something about a swimsuit and everybody smiles and claps. And that's when you know she's done. She's never going to shut this program down because they liked her stuff about the swimsuit.
It's all about winning hearts and minds, Gray. And sometimes that works both ways.
Not with me, it doesn't.
Anyway, Operation Christmas Drop now streaming on Netflix. And in the coming weeks, they've got Jingle Jangle is going to drop on Friday. That is this very ambitious Christmas musical they've got that is executive produced by John Legend. And in a couple of weeks, the Dolly Parton Christmas on the Square, which we have things to talk about when we get there. But we're under embargo, so we're not going to do it now. All right. Then speaking of movies that are only opening in theaters, Let Him Go opens this week.
Let him go. Let him go.
Gray, you want a plot synopsis on this?
Oh, sure. Kevin Costner and Diane Lane are these just down home Montana folk that are happy, happy, happy living off the grid with their son and his wife and their grandbaby, who's like toddler age. So saying baby was wrong, but I obviously don't have children. And tragically, their son dies. And when life rolls on, their daughter-in-law remarries, but he is a bad man. And yes, he packs the family up. He takes them away in the middle of the night. And this is coming after Diane Lane sees exactly what kind of man he really is. And so she tells Kevin Costner, we're going to go get our grandbaby. And they are unprepared at first for what lies in wait when they finally find these people. But let's just say that Oscar winners will never be kept down.
Now, they're not entirely happy on the farm. One of the things I like about this movie is that, like, while this starts out with a very sort of Norman Rockwell-y kind of, like, you know, Americana thing, there's a lot simmering in that marriage. And there's a lot simmering, like, between them and the daughter-in-law and stuff that like, clearly is going to have to be addressed by the end of the movie. And it is. So I liked a lot of the tension there. It was, you know, they are very Montana in terms of like not being super talky people, but that allows Costner and Diane Lane to do a lot of like glance acting, which I think is really effective here.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like there's a scene where he goes to a liquor store and he buys himself a little, like, you know, a fifth or whatever. And she kind of looks and he kind of looks back and he's like, could we not have this argument again? She's like, well, you know what I think. And that's it. And it's like, okay, that's, you've just given me decades of a marriage right there in that exchange, you know?
Yes.
No, go ahead.
When, and one of my favorite things about these kinds of movies that are like such slow burns is that they set up these people so well. So if the intonation of my voice is important, when I say Kevin Costner, Diane Lane, Leslie Manville, because she comes in like a gale force wind, honey.
Holy magoli. Yeah. Like we talked about this on Breakfast All Day, and Chrissy's like, she wafts in from another movie. And Matt was saying that, like, she clearly thought, oh, this is my Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom moment. And I think I would have bought all of those things and the bigness of the performance and the sort of, like, you know, the intent, the grandness of her evil, you know, if she'd gotten the accent a little better. You know, but okay. I kept catching her being British, and I was like, Leslie Manville, you're awesome, but maybe a few more weeks with the coach on this one. But yeah, so that's, and then her brother is played by Jeffrey Donovan, and he's very creepy and intense in this, again, in a very quiet way. Like the people who say the least in this movie really make the most impact in a lot of ways. It's written and directed by Thomas Bazooka, who 20 years ago had a really impressive debut with a movie called Big Eden that Dave and I were big fans of. It's a gay love story that unfolds in a small town in Montana. And it's this kind of like, I often refer to it as the movie that manifests the idea of, like, become the change you wish to see in the world. Like, this is a movie that is not about the world that exists. It's about the way that I want it to be. So it's a small town in Montana where all the people in town get together and conspire to bring these two dudes together. You know, they all sort of matchmake for them, and it's really charming and lovely, and it's a movie that I love a lot. And then since then, I have not been crazy about, you know, he did The Family Stone, which I know some people dig as a holiday movie, not Woo! A fan. He did the very, are you a Family Stone person?
Woo!
Okay, fair enough. And then Monte Carlo, which nobody remembers, and one or two other things. But this movie felt like, oh yes, okay, this is the movie that I thought the guy who made Big Eden was going to go on to make, and now finally he's making it. So I think this is super effective and, like, really tense. Like, I was kind of yelling at the TV for the last 15 or 20 minutes. It was it's a lot happening.
I have been silent during this review because I have not yet seen this film in its entirety. I've seen about 7 complete minutes. And when it is available to stream, I will sit down and watch it, because the things I did see, Leslie Manville and her questionable accent, and yet at the same time, her amazing presence.
Oh yeah.
That made me want to, you know, check in on it. And I gotta say, the production design of this film is just chef's kiss. The color story going on is perfectly vintage 1960s, Midwest United States, rural kind of small town, last picture show kind of stuff.
The flatness of it all.
And I can't get enough of that. So I'll be checking in on this one when it's available to stream. Right now, it's only in theaters.
Only in theaters.
Don't go to a movie theater,
no,
you guys.
Heavens no.
Don't do that.
But it's, again, but it's Focus, which is, like, so it's part of that whole AMC Universal deal, which means they have to go into theaters, but B, they will be streaming real quick.
It'll be streaming by Christmas.
Yeah, for sure. So put a pin in that one, and you can come back to it later.
Here's what I did see.
Yes.
I mean, I also watched Operation Dumbo Drop, Christmas Drop, but that's not a real movie.
You didn't really see it.
I was sitting right here at the dining room table, paying bills, doing work, and looking at the TV while you were looking at the TV. I just paid enough attention to it that I knew I didn't have to pay a complete amount of attention to it.
Fine.
Because it stinks. Here's what doesn't stink. The new documentary from Frederick Wiseman.
Yay.
Legendary documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. It opened last week. We held off until this week to talk about it. It's in virtual cinemas.
Yes.
All over. In order to find it, though, you're going to have to go to your local virtual cinema on the internet, or
go to zippora.com, ZIPPORAH.
Or just type in City Hall Frederick Wiseman, because if you just type in City Hall, you know, you're just going to get the name of your own City Hall. This is a four and a half hour documentary from Frederick Wiseman. And if you know Frederick Wiseman, you know that his documentaries can last anywhere between 90 minutes and 6 hours. And so sometimes you get a short one and sometimes you get
Ex Libris,
a marathon workout. This is one of the marathons.
Yes.
But here's what's wonderful about his marathons. You don't really feel like you're doing any heavy lifting. Mm-mm. You are immersing yourself. He is immersing you in the operations of a town or an institution or a local like government facility or, you know, service. And so here we are in Boston in 2018-ish.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. At Boston City Hall. And the workings of an American city, a major American city.
Yeah.
We see how it works. And I don't think people now, and this is something we've clearly witnessed over the past 4 years, people seem to neither know nor care how governing bodies govern. Because a city hall, the governance of a city is as important as the governance of a country. And a city has to function much the same way that a government has to function, a federal government or a state government has to function. And so given the past 4 years where the Trump administration just didn't bother to fill positions for keeping the federal government functioning, why systems started breaking down so wildly, why the IRS couldn't deal with, you know, getting taxes done. Why the U.S. Postal Service, you know, well, that was intentionally sabotaged.
Right, but why along with the pandemic office.
Yeah, why no one was prepared for anything when the pandemic hit? Why, when natural disasters came, nothing was ready. Nothing was ready to help Puerto Rico. So he went there and threw paper towels at people.
Yeah.
Like, this was a four-year situation where the people in charge of the government actively hated the idea of government and they let it disintegrate. And they did it intentionally by neglect and by ineptitude. And so this is a documentary about a city government that is working really hard to function.
Yeah.
You see planning meetings and planning meetings and planning meetings. And if you've ever watched a Frederick Wiseman film,
he loves a meeting.
He loves a planning meeting of a ballet company, of
libraries,
of a library system, you name it.
Department stores.
He loves a planning meeting. You get to see the opening day at Fenway Park and everybody singing Sweet Caroline. And I was scanning the crowd for my brother and sister-in-law because they are there every opening day. They live in Massachusetts. You know, you get to see the functioning of a of this, the way the city addresses unhoused people, specifically teenagers. You get to work. You get to be a part of a veterans group discussion. You get to be a part of an immigration panel. You get to be a part of, you get to watch parking tickets happen.
Yes. And being fought. You get to watch and the people who are monitoring the traffic cameras and figuring out what they have to do to ease that. I know I could have watched a whole movie about that. A celebration of nurses, a Goodwill Thanksgiving dinner, as well as a Thanksgiving pantry, you know, kind of food bank situation, like all this inner working,
sanitation.
There's a garbage truck sequence in this movie that is like one of the most poetic moments of a movie I've seen all year.
I watched it twice. I was like, can I just see that garbage truck eat that stuff again?
Yeah, please throw the mattress in again. I want
like,
to see
when it comes to garbage trucks, I'm like a 3-year-old. I just want to look at it and do its thing. You know, oh, we're just going to throw a giant backyard grill into the garbage truck and watch it chomp it.
Yeah.
You know,
you see people getting married. You see the 311 operators. You know, you see the police press conference after Boston wins this is the World Series.
I don't know.
Some sports thing where they're like, okay, we know you're going to celebrate, but, you know, please do so calmly, everyone. you know, all just all of this stuff. And then you also see like civic engagement. It's not just about the government sitting around and making decisions and coming up with stuff. There's this extended sequence where there's a community meeting about a marijuana dispensary,
a medical marijuana dispensary
that wants to come into this, you know, working class neighborhood. And the people from the neighborhood are like, you know, and the dispensary people are sort of mouthing all of these kind of platitudes and bromides about what they're going to bring to the neighborhood and jobs and da, da, da. And everybody's like, what about the parking? Where are they going to line up? What about hiring people who went to jail for selling the exact same stuff that you guys are now going to be legally selling?
Right.
Like, and it is just such this amazing level of engagement. And, you know, Wiseman never narrates and he never interviews and he doesn't put words on the screen. So he's not telling you what he's telling you, but he's telling you. And what he's telling you with this movie specifically is that, like, we can't just sort of sit around and allow the world to exist around us. Like, we have to be involved, and we have to be involved with an institution that is overseeing stuff and the government really matters.
And it's always, always, always fascinating.
Yeah.
Because here we are talking to you about one of his governmental, you know, institutional body films. And you can divide up his films into you know, categories.
Yeah. You can pair this one with like Belfast, Maine, or Public Housing, or In Jackson Heights, or right. Monrovia, Indiana.
And sometimes when we are describing a Frederick Wiseman film, you think, this is a movie. Why would I want to watch this? And all you have to see is one of them.
Yeah.
And you'll understand why, because he is using quotidian stuff in a poetic way to tell you the story of how people live and what's important to them and why these things are important. This one is unusual for one reason.
It has a star.
It has a star. Normally, Wiseman films have no star. If it's about a community, you just see all these folks, and you might only see them for 10 minutes, and then they're gone. But this one has a star. And I can't tell, honestly, if it's for better or worse that it has a star. But the star of this movie is Mayor Marty Walsh.
Yeah.
A man who is seemingly cloned and can be in 9 places at the same time. You see him everywhere. He is a regular fixture in this film. He pops up at this meeting, that event, cutting this ribbon, handing out this turkey on Thanksgiving. He's
at a luncheon for senior citizens talking about identity theft and just like everywhere.
We'll put aside from the fact, just for a moment, that he is Dreamboat Dad of 2020. All right.
He would go as a hot mayor. Who's the guy in The Simpsons?
I don't know. But what now?
Hot Quimby.
Yes, he would be Hot Quimby for Halloween.
The
same accent too.
And what I wonder about is, Wiseman only ever shows him in his official capacity, and only ever shows him as sort of a earnest, pretty progressive, or at the very least center left,
yeah,
competent, no nonsense, caring dude. At the same time, there's got to be something else, right? There's got to be moments where he's failing to listen, failing to do what the community needs,
right?
Failing to pay attention to something, but we don't see that.
Well, here's the thing. We do, there is one.
Because he can't be Superman. He can't be perfect.
Of course. There's one meeting at the end where we see him.
Yeah.
That it's like, it's very close. You know, it's like 4 people, and it's very kind of like sleeves rolled up. But the thing is, I think the modern politician never forgets the cameras in the room.
I know.
And so like, even when he is seemingly at his most like, off stage, because you're right, most of the film we see him behind one podium or other,
right?
Even then, like, you can tell he's very measured in what he's talking about, and he's always on brand and on message. But I think what he brings to the movie is this level of empathy with so many different communities.
Yes.
So when he's talking to veterans about substance abuse, he talks about his own substance abuse.
Yes.
When he is praising nurses for their work, he talks about having cancer as a child and the importance that nurses played in his recovery and in helping his family out during that whole trauma. So he's not just getting up there and sort of mouthing these platitudes that don't mean anything. That if you know, what's the line? If you can, sincerity is the most important thing, and if you can fake that, you can do anything.
Right.
Even if he's faking sincerity, he's at least making the effort to fake sincerity, which a lot of politicians don't even do that.
I understand that the narrative thrust of this film is to show a functioning government.
Right.
Wiseman has already been quoted. This is a quote as saying, this is an anti-Trump film because it's a film about a city that functions. Mm. And which he normally doesn't editorialize outside of
really
thing. Not that I've ever been aware of. Like, I don't ever hear him talking about his film and telling you what it means to him.
But he's doing it now.
But this is, he's doing this.
Ooh, some great cooking demos too.
And so that is, there really were. Yeah. But so that is my one wonder about the film. Like, Mayamati, who is he really? And I,
interesting and I, that I, it's lacking that as well. Like, it's interesting that it's lacking that side, and that he, I wonder if the two are connected.
I don't know. I want to believe that, listen, this movie made me believe that Mayor Marty is the best. Does anyone live in Boston and know something different?
Yeah, please, like, tell us. Who,
please tell us, because everything we know about him now comes from this film.
But again, I think that part of that is locked into the way that Wiseman makes movies, because another filmmaker to avoid that would go interview a political rival, would go interview somebody who had a bad experience with the mayor's office, but he doesn't do that.
Right.
Like, what he's going to do is just sort of like, he's going to show you these different facets, and the facets that he got just didn't ever show Mayor Marty dropping the ball.
Right.
Which isn't to say that Mayor Marty hasn't ever dropped the ball.
Right.
But anyway,
I'm not looking for dirt on Mayor Marty. I'm just wondering, is this sort of shining example of civic, you know, responsibility, everything that we need,
violate the point that he was trying to make if he showed this mayor being less than competent at some point?
Right.
If you've never seen a Wiseman movie, if you have a library card, you go to canopy.com, depending on where you live, K-A-N-O-P-Y. They have pretty much all of his movies there. And I always recommend people start with The Store, which is relatively short. It's about the Neiman Marcus flagship store in Dallas.
It's easy breezy too.
And it is, but it will get you hooked.
Fun.
That's your gateway drug for Frederick Wiseman.
It really is.
I love listening to you guys talk about anything, but especially Wiseman documentaries. And this to me sounds like Parks and Rec and Leslie Knope in real life.
without the comedy. Yeah. And it's available, like I said, it's available any virtual cinema that you are aware of, and
or one that you can hop onto, even if it isn't your local one.
You can spend the whole afternoon watching this, and you will.
It's 4.5 hours, but it doesn't feel like, it's a 4.5 hour movie.
Dump work for the day. Just sit around and watch this.
As they would say on Parks and Rec, treat yourself.
Yeah, treat yourself to the new Frederick Wiseman documentary.
We are going to skip letters just because we have a guest and this is a
so much time
whole thing, but we would love to hear from you, whether it's about Mayor Marty or anything else. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
We would like to hear specifically directly from Mayor Marty.
Oh, well, sure, if he's listening, and I'm sure he is. Gray, where can the folks find you online?
Well, all my social channels are under my name, so don't forget my first name is spelled real weird because my family loves vowels. G-R-A-E-D-R-A-K-E. And that's all across the web. And subscribe to my YouTube channel and you'll watch me cry with strangers. Not always, but sometimes.
Well, just the hint of it is enough to get us sucked in. y'all, it's been... I can't even wrap my head around the fact that we've been doing this for 10 years. So whether you are, whether you've been with us from Jump Street, as they say, or you are
who says that except you?
I kind of stole it from We Hate Movies.
Anyway, all right.
If you've been around this whole time, if you just started, if you're a relatively recent listener, Thank you for being here. If you're a Patreon subscriber, double thank you for being here. And if you want to become one, we do have this Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. Lots of extra content, including, like I said, shows about TV and food and, you know, sometimes
other topics.
Other topics. Yeah. Lots of things. Go check that out.
Different places.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. This show, of course, is and will always be free, and you can subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts, and do leave us a 5-star review when you're there. We'll read it on the show. It helps people find us. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places where we stream, including Spotify and Amazon Music and Google Play, CastBox, Podbean, Stitcher, thelounge.com. You can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. Check him out over on Twitter at BLEUTOPIA. See what he's up to. Gray, you're the best. We're always grateful, and we always love getting to see your face and hear your voice.
I agree.
I just love you guys so dang much. I just love you so much. Thank you for having me, and congratulations on this gigantic milestone that so few people reach. And on behalf of your audience, thank you for sharing yourselves with us.
Oh, well, it's been a delight for us. If we weren't having fun, we wouldn't do it. So thank you, everybody, that makes this thing happen.
Alonzo would still keep making me do it.
Maybe. But, you know, it's got to be fun to enjoy.
For love. For love.
Yeah, for love. We do it for love.
All right. Check out all of our friends on the internet. Go see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Listen to Schmoes Know, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Big Fat Gay Podcast, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. And I want to add this week to that list.
Yes.
The Workroom. The Workroom, which is a show about Project Runway, and it is often featuring our very dear friend Nayland Blake. So he's always got fun stuff to say. Go check that out as well. Everybody, 2020 is the worst, but you know, it's been great to have you guys along this ride with us, and we love hearing from you, and we're thrilled that you're still wanting to hear our blather. So keep on keeping on. Take care of yourselves and each other. We'll be back next week with more. And until then,
goodbye.